Who's liable when a sidewalk falls into disrepair and someone gets hurt? That's one of the questions we'll be looking at this hour as we hear about recent cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In rare fashion, the court's rulings this year prompted the legislature to amend three Iowa laws. We'll hear about that, as well as cases involving driving while under the influence, and one that asked whether or not having the county visible on your license plate gives the police license to pull you over. Our guests, Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law and Des Moines litigator Ryan Copemans. Cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Who's liable when a sidewalk falls into disrepair and someone gets hurt? If the license plate frame you have on your car covers the county on your license plate, can the police pull you over just because of that fact? Can you run for public office if you've been convicted of operating a vehicle while under the influence? These are several questions at the heart of several cases we'll be reviewing this hour as we look at recent cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. We like to do this every so often with some legal experts in order to find out how these interesting cases were decided and also to find out how they impact us as Iowan. And some of them, in fact, have impacts nationwide. Todd Pettis is with us, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd Pettis, welcome back to our program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
And Ryan Copemans is with us. He's in our Des Moines studio. Ryan is a litigator with Nymaster Good in Des Moines. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have both of you on our program today. We want to reach out to our listeners and ask if you've got questions about these cases, please feel free to give us a call, write us an email, or perhaps a case about how the Iowa Supreme Court works. 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk about a case, first of all, Todd, let's start with you, a case that will, I'm sure, have a good number of our listeners, including me, checking our license plate frames.
Yeah, that's right. We talk on public radio about driveway moments where people right. sit and listen to stories they enjoy.
Different kind of,
we're adding a new dimension to the motto. The case comes from a factual setting. Many listeners probably would feel they have no connection with. A man named Craig Harrison was pulled over by the police and ultimately convicted of possessing crack cocaine with intent to distribute. But what makes this case so significant really for all Iowans is the reason Mr. Harrison was pulled over was because the police believed that his license plate frame violated state law. And there's a statute that says that you cannot, it's a crime to put a frame around your license plate if that frame does not leave visible all of the numbers and letters on the license plate. So the issue in the case was, is that just talking about your license plate number, or does it literally mean every letter of any kind, including the letters that are used to spell the name of the county? And the Supreme Court held, by a divided vote here, 5-2, the Supreme Court held that it means the entire plate. And so if you have a license plate frame that is covering up, so it's illegible, that county name, which appears at the very bottom, that violates state law, and that in itself is a sufficient basis for the police to pull you over. In Mr. Harrison's case, that really the least of his problems. In fact, in the end, I don't think he was even charged with violating that law. In the course of the exchange they had with Mr. Harrison after pulling him over, you know, they got onto the whole thing about crack cocaine. But it's worth taking a look at the right. back
and,
of your
and
car.
It's not an insignificant number of license plate frames that do cover that up. I have this nerdy habit of when I travel, I like to see what county people are from, and I like, oh, there's Pottawatomie, there's Dallas, there's Polk, and then things yeah. like that to yeah. pass the time. Well, and I notice in a good number of cases, I can't tell.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you say that you take notice of that county name, because when a majority of the court majority was trying to sort out, now, what is it that the legislature intended to make sure remain visible, the court said, for a lot of people, when they see a car and they're trying to identify it, say a car leaving a crime scene, they may not be able to remember the license plate number, but if they catch a unique looking county name, that becomes a basis for beginning to at least identify the car. And so the court said there's value to that information. You know, if the Iowa legislature thinks that the court got it wrong, they could go in and amend the statute. But until that happens, that's where we are.
Quickly, Todd, before we move on, is this in keeping with rulings in other states? I know not all states have counties on their license plates.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of states don't. I believe the court went through and took a look at, it's not a large number, took a look at some other states, but ultimately the court decided this case based on what it thought the Iowa legislature meant and what made the most policy sense.
Okay. Ryan Kopmans, let me turn to you for this next case. We want to deal now with a couple of cases that also deal with driving, but in this case, driving under the influence. A case, is it Chiodo?
Chido.
Chido. Chido. What's going on in the story behind this one?
Well, this is my favorite case of the term, actually. It has so many plots, subplots, and sub-subplots going on here. Drunk driving is kind of the surface of it. So there's an open Senate seat, state Senate seat, in the south side of Des Moines because Senator Jack Hatch is running for governor. And we had three primary competitors in that race, Ned Chido, Tony Bisignano, and Nathan Blake, a young attorney at the Attorney General's office. Shortly before he decided to run, Tony Bisignano got an OWI second, which actually was his third OWI, but because he got the second and the third in such close succession, it was called an OWI second, which is an aggravated misdemeanor. And while he did not get prison time, that crime is subject to prison time, prison being different from jail, county jail, as opposed to state prison, state pen. You get the difference. So Ned Chido filed a challenge to Bisignano's candidacy saying, look, you've been charged with a crime that is subject to prison time. The Iowa Constitution says that no person who has been convicted of a, quote, infamous crime can be an elector. An elector means you have to be an elector to be able to run for office or to vote. And the Iowa Supreme Court said a long time ago that any crime that is subject to prison is a, quote, infamous crime. So Chido challenged Bisignano's candidacy, and that went to the Attorney General, Tom Miller, to the Secretary of State, and to the auditor. And that three-person panel decided that no, an OWI second is not an infamous crime. Within a week, it went to the district court. Within a week after that, it went to the Supreme Court. And within a week after that, the Supreme Court decided the case. And in what is could be the biggest case that the Iowa Supreme Court decided this year, the justices said that no, an OWI second, an aggravated misdemeanor, is not an infamous crime.
Mm-hmm. And what makes this the most interesting case for you this term, Ryan?
Well, legally speaking, it is so broad because it doesn't just touch on whether someone can run for office, but it touches on whether someone can vote. And so, what the Supreme Court said in a very splintered decision, five justices said that an aggravated misdemeanor is not an infamous crime. One said that it is. But you had a further splinter than that. So three justices said that, look, a crime has to at least be a felony to be infamous. But beyond that, it also has to be a crime that infects the integrity of the democratic process, the voting process. And they didn't say what that meant in this case. They left that open. And then two other justices said, look, if it's a felony at all, then it's an infamous crime and you can't vote. So why that's important is because we have a big election coming up, and we also have a presidential election coming up in 2 years. We have caucuses coming up soon. And it is in complete disarray as to who can vote, what kind of felons can vote. So, for example, if you're a drug dealer and you've been convicted of a felony, is that an infamous crime? Well, we don't know. Three justices might say no, because they might say, well, look, you sold drugs, yes, but it's not like you were cheating. It wasn't voter fraud. It wasn't something that affects the ballot process. And three justices would say, yes, it does. Now, the other interesting thing about this is that there is one other justice, Justice Apple, who recused himself from this case because his wife, Stacey Apple, most likely this is why he recused himself, his wife, Stacey Apple, is running for Congress in the 3rd District. And, of course, a decision about who can vote is probably a little too close to home for him, so he recused. So we might have to wait to see what Justice Apple says about all this to see who can vote and who can't.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you had that explanation because one would think, well, why not use the same division that we use in law when we say one crime is a felony and another is a misdemeanor? But for reasons that you've explained, we want to have it more, I guess, nuanced than that.
Well, some do, some don't. And so that's what we'll have to wait to find out where the court's going to go on that. And it could be a big decision. And ultimately, you could have, for example, felons who are in prison, but who would be eligible to vote because their crime does not affect the voting process. So maybe we have to send them absentee ballots. I don't know.
And then in this case, how do we compare with other states? Do the states have this similar gray area, non-clarity?
Every state has its own constitutional provision, and I'm not sure that they're what goes on in other states exactly. So we'll have to find out.
Okay, good. Just coming to mind here, we're talking about DUI, driving under the influence, but you also use this operating while intoxicated. Is that the acronym there? And I don't know if Ryan or Todd can answer this. What is the difference between those two? They're both can talk about the same thing. Ryan, do you know, or Todd?
Nothing.
There is no difference.
Yeah, I mean, some states call it a DUI. We call it an OWI. Essentially, and I suppose there could be permutations about what has intoxicated you, and maybe Todd can expand on that and enlighten us about
right.
that. But I think
you sensed where I was going because so many states are. We have some states that have now legalized marijuana and medical marijuana and so forth. So. We're not just talking about alcohol. I know in the next case we will specifically talk about alcohol, but driving under a DUI can mean more than alcohol.
Yes, I think it may be driving while impaired, maybe a DWI. I don't know that that's the acronym, but I believe Iowa is among the states. Not all states do this, but some states do this. They stretch the net to include not just alcohol, but you know, prescription drugs, controlled substances, marijuana, cocaine. And as I say, prescribed drugs, all of those things are capable of impairing one's ability to drive. And so a number of states, including Iowa, have taken a shot at trying to say whether you are allowed to have any of those substances in your body at all while you drive, or if you are, how much of it can you have?
Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law. Ryan Copeman's with Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Two of our legal beagles, to pick apart the latest Iowa Supreme Court cases, make sense of them for us. The very interesting stories, often in themselves, but also we want to find out the impact that they may have on us. And let's talk about another case that concerns driving under the influence. This one specifically, alcohol. Todd, Iowa v. Lukens. Tell us that story.
Yeah, Tony Lukens was pulled over on suspicion of drunk driving in Sutherland, Iowa. And if the police officer's account is accurate, there were reasons, even before we get into precise blood alcohol content levels, reasons to think that he may have been under the influence. He drove away, according to the officer, at a very high speed, about 80 miles an hour. At one point, he veered in and out of a ditch. When he finally pulled over, the police officer said that he smelled of alcohol and had slurred speech and so forth. And so the officer gave him a preliminary breath test out in the field, which indicated he was over the legal limit, which is 0.08. They go back to the station and they pull out the breathalyzer, which is, I think, more precise, and he blew a 0.207. So he's substantially, if that number's accurate, he is substantially over the legal limit for how much alcohol he can have. Now, it's at that point where he started asking for some form of a do-over. His words and the court's opinion has a transcript of this exchange because it was captured on the police station's videotape. He asked for a recheck several times, and apparently he was bleeding from the chin when he was pulled over, and part of the transcript indicates that maybe he thought the fact that he was bleeding would affect the test results, and the police officer expresses understandable skepticism about that, at which point Mr. Lukens says, you know, I don't know exactly what to ask for, but I'm just, you know, can we do a recheck? And later he starts asking for a re-blow, and he's pointing at least on one occasion, to the breathalyzer machine. Now, you don't have a right under Iowa law to multiple shots at the breathalyzer. Once the police officers give you the breathalyzer, you blow a number. If they wish, they don't have to give you any more cracks at it. And that's the position that the officer on duty there took. There is, however, a statute, a different statute, that says that you may have an alternative test, a chemical test of your alcohol level, say through blood or through urine, at your own expense. And the issue in this case was when Mr. Lukens was trying to say, can I have a recheck of some kind, was that request sufficient to invoke any right he might have under this statute a blood test?
He would have to, at the roadside, organize, or at the police station, organize an independent test. That would be on his shoulders.
I don't think that he would act. I don't know actually who would do the who would facilitate it. Given the circumstances, my suspicion is that the equipment would be provided by the police department, or sure, they'd have to call in the people, because of course your blood alcohol diminishes as time passes. So time is relatively of the essence. What the court held in this case was that if the request you make, you don't have to know that you're entitled to a blood or urine test rather than a breathalyzer. If you say anything that can reasonably be understood as a request for some kind of alternative test, then the officer has to explain to you your options. And the court drew an analogy. We always talk about, do you have a right to a phone call? Under Iowa law, when it comes to telephone calls, you have a right to call a friend. You have a right to call a family member or an attorney. And there was a prior case where someone had said, can I call a friend? And in that case, the court said, you don't have to know the details of your rights. If you're in the ballpark, this is my language now, not the court's, if you're in the ballpark of asking for the right thing, then the officer has to clarify for you exactly what you are entitled to get and what you're not. And the court drew an analogy to those telephone calls here and said that in Mr. Lukens' case, asking for a recheck was sufficient. And so they've suppressed the breathalyzer and they've sent it back for a new trial and said, we're going to do this all over again because it appears that Mr. Lukens didn't get what he should have gotten in this case.
So those listening should take away from this what?
Well, depends on whether you're a drunk driver or whether you think the legislature ought to do something to crack down on more heavily on drunk driving. If you're someone, to your discredit, who drinks and drives, we know something now about your rights and how to invoke them. We also have a legislative issue that the legislature can address, and it can clarify, do you indeed have a right? The court assumed in this case that you have a right to a recheck. The statute, mm-hmm, however, uses permissive language. It says you may get a recheck. Does that leave it up to the police officer's discretion? The legislature could take a position on those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can back up here, too. Do you have before this step was taken, just basically when you are pulled over, perhaps it was as simple as you took a couple sips of beer and the officer does smell something on your breath. What happens when you approve or refuse sort of that breathalyzer?
Well, when you approve, of course, it happens.
Yes.
I believe that under Iowa law, if you refuse the breathalyzer and police need to advise you of this, and Ryan, you tell me whether you know this is accurate, I believe you lose your driving privileges for a good length of time. So there's consequences that come with refusing to take it.
That's correct. But usually we charge by the hour for that advice, Todd.
Well, maybe on public radio airwaves you
it's
can make an
radio
exception.
It is right. Right. People have paid for this already.
Is that an in-kind donation?
No, people have contributed, and now they're getting a payback.
Like Ryan Copeman's with us, and Todd Pettis talking about recent cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. If you have a question about a case or would like to know how the court works, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. A few minutes that we have remaining before we take a break. Let's turn to you, Todd, about an issue that is universal and may have people checking not only their license plate frames but the sidewalks outside of their houses. So Madden v. City of Iowa City. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is a very important. If you own property that has a sidewalk that runs along it, it's very important to know what the court said in this case. Prior to this case, the Iowa legislature had already made clear that you, and I'll say you now, talking to the property owners who have sidewalks that run along their property, you as property owners must take reasonable steps to remove snow and ice. And if you don't take reasonable steps to remove snow and ice, you're liable when someone gets hurt as a result. Now, there is a question about, well, what happens, you know, like this time of year? Snow and ice isn't an issue, but suppose you've got cracks or the equivalent of potholes in your sidewalk, and suppose someone gets injured then. That's what happened to Beth Madden. She was riding her bike along a sidewalk in Iowa City. She fell. She alleges that it's because of the defect in the sidewalk, so she sued the city of Iowa City. The city of Iowa City said, well, we have an ordinance here, okay, so not a state statute, but law made at the city level. We in Iowa City have an ordinance that says to property owners, you must maintain the sidewalks in good repair, and you are liable for injuries if you don't. And so the question in this case was, can cities shift all responsibility, financial responsibility for injuries onto the property owners? And the Supreme Court held in this case that the answer to that question is yes, they can. And so if you live in Iowa City, I can tell you with great assurance, because it's the case, there is an ordinance that says you are liable if someone gets hurt because of any cracks that are out there in that sidewalk.
And I would imagine city administrators across the state take note of this, because it would be in the interest of a city financially to shift that blame.
Absolutely. I've talked briefly with the Iowa City attorney who litigated this case to see whether he happened to know whether other cities, how many other cities have this, and I don't know, and he wasn't sure either. But he and I both kind of said to each other, whatever the number is probably going to get larger. Because we now, if city officials didn't already know, you know, outside Iowa City, mm-hmm. if city officials didn't already know they could do this, the answer now from the Supreme Court is that they can. State law permits states to put it on the property owner. And so what your insurance policy is, how much coverage you have, those are important questions for property owners mm-hmm. now.
I wonder, give us an idea of the arguments in this case. What would be argued on the side of the... the people saying, you know, it's not the, it is the city's problem.
Well, under state law, the state statute had said that cities must maintain sidewalks in good repair, but they can turn to property owners, and cities may require property owners to keep them in good repair. And so I live in Iowa City. I already knew, because I've gotten a bill for this in the past with property I have. We've always known that the city can require you to pay when they have to repair your sidewalk, and they come out here in Iowa City and spray paint them from time to time as they make the rounds, and you either find a contractor to fix the sidewalk or the city does it, and then they send you a bill. So we always knew that. The issue here was, well, that was authorized by state law, but state law, which made it clear that property owners are liable for snow and ice, state law did not make it absolutely clear that property owners are or can be made liable for injuries that happen from sidewalk defects. Separate from snow and ice. So that's, you know, boiled down to what was the intent of the legislature. Did they intend to leave cities like Iowa City free to do what they did? The court said yes.
So clarity here, as opposed to the other cases that we've had, we do have clarity, and it's for the entire state.
That's right.
That the ordinances of the city can, in this case, prevail.
That's exactly right. It's statewide. If you live in a city that has done this or that does it, you're on the hook financially if someone trips and falls and you were unreasonable and not getting that crack fixed sooner.
Todd Pettis, we've learned so much this hour that we can put to good use. Check out your license plate frames
yes.
so you don't get pulled over, and check out your sidewalks so that you don't get caught there as well. Todd Pettis with us of Ryan and Ryan Copeman's of Nymaster Good in Des Moines in our Des Moines studio. When we come back, we want to talk about a few cases that prompted the Iowa legislature to amend law, one that has to do with solar energy, a nationally watched Iowa Supreme Court case when we return. And also we'll talk about some other aspects, the Iowa Farm Bureau v. Environmental Protection Commission, and Palmer College Chiropractic. We'll talk about that in a case when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good you could join us for this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this hour, we've been going through recent Iowa Supreme Court decisions to see spin out these stories, sometimes very interesting stories, how our law continues to be made and remade and decided, interpreted by the courts. Todd Pettis is with us, helping to do that, Associate Dean for Faculty in the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law, along with Ryan Copemans, litigator with Nymaster Good in Des Moines. And this half hour, we want to take a look at several cases that prompted the legislature to amend law. So The legislature reacted to the ruling. It happened three times this year. That's not something that happens this often usually, is it, Ryan?
It's not this frequently. And something unique about this year was that the legislature did it two times, not in reaction to the Supreme Court decision, but reaction to the case itself before the Supreme Court even decided. And really what happened with a couple of these cases is that the advocates were able to use the story, were able to paint a picture and show how these laws affect real people, which is, you know, why Todd and I come on here. And because they got the Iowa Supreme Court case, got these issues out into the public, the legislature thought, well, maybe we should change the law a little bit. Mm-hmm. And the first case—
Before we get to that first case, I want to go to a caller here because we want to make sure we tie up any loose ends to do with our sidewalk. And Mark in Iowa City has a question that has to do with the sidewalk case from Iowa City, whether you're liable to liable for someone injured on your sidewalk if it falls into disrepair. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah. So if the city hasn't notified me yet of damage to my sidewalk, I know there's different degrees of damage, and somebody falls on my sidewalk, gets injured, am I still liable for that if I hadn't fixed it?
Yes, you are. The way the Iowa City ordinance reads, it does not say that you're liable if the city notifies that you that there's a problem and you fail to take action. I think the law is premised on the assumption that you live there. You can see the problems, and the Iowa City ordinance says that you're responsible to maintain it, and you're liable if you don't. And so if you see something there that you can imagine someone easily tripping over or grabbing the wheel of a bike and turning in a wrong direction, I think you're well advised to deal with it and not to wait for the city. I'm sympathetic to the question. I mentioned in the last segment that I had to do sidewalk repair at my own expense before, and I didn't know about this ordinance at the time, and I'm not sure when the ordinance came on the books, but my kind of default had always been, well, if I see the cracks and I kind of dread the day the city shows up and tells me I have to shell out some money to pay for them. The dynamic is now clearly different. You don't wait for the city.
Okay, Mark, sorry if that affects you negatively, but great question.
Is there a degree of is there a stated degree of
what would you use to measure that? How
specific?
The law doesn't define things like, you know, cracks of a certain fraction of an inch. It's not like that. A general quick rule of thumb, handing out legal advice here without looking at it or even being a specialist in this area, reasonableness always comes into play. And so take a look at that. Maybe ask your friends what you think. Are you being unreasonable in knowing about those defects and not taking any action? If you're being reasonable, my shooting from the hip guess would be you may well be okay. But, you know, the litigation is going to cost you something. You have to hire an attorney to argue that you were reasonable. It's going to be a lot cheaper to spend
avoid
a few dollars
in the first place.
It.
And after all, we are talking about the safety of people, perhaps children on bikes, whatever. Mark, great question from Iowa City. Thanks for that follow-up. Now let's go to Ryan here and talk about one of these cases that prompted the legislature here in Iowa to amend the law. Eagle Point Solar v. Iowa Utilities Board. Tell us about that one, Ryan.
Yeah, as you said before the break, it was a case that received national attention. So there's a company in Iowa that manufactures and installs solar panels on large buildings, but they don't sell the solar panels to the company. What they do is they sell the power that comes from the solar panels in what's called a power purchase agreement. And many times they do it that way because they're putting these solar panels on public buildings or on nonprofits. And those entities can't take advantage of the tax credits that the federal and the state government give. So the question, Eagle Point Solar went to the Iowa Utilities Board and they said, hey, we're selling our power to these individual customers with individual solar panels. Does that make us a public utility? We don't think so, but we want you to tell us. And the reason why that is so important is because if they are a public utility, then it is illegal for them to sell that power because within that jurisdiction, Alliant Energy has an exclusive arrangement. Only they can sell. They are the only public utility that can sell electricity in that area. The Iowa Utilities Board said, yes, you are a public utility, which effectively would have killed what Eagle Point wanted to do. Eagle Point appealed to the district court, which reversed the Iowa Utilities Board. And then the Iowa Utilities Board appealed that to the Iowa Supreme Court. And in a split decision, the Iowa Supreme Court said, no, you are not a public utility, and it was a very big win for solar energy.
Interesting, because we want to make clear here, too, if you put a solar panel on your own house and you use it for your own consumption, you've long since been in the right there. You can do that. But this is selling panels as a business, selling that energy. So what are the implications? Why was this watched nationally? What is it, what are the ripples here?
Well, again, it's one of these kind of unintended consequences of tax policy. And the ripples are, if they were a public utility because they sold it per kilowatt basis, then you would not be able to, a lot of public organizations, cities, municipalities, and nonprofits would not be able to afford to put these solar panels on because they wouldn't be able to get these very valuable tax credits. So it kind of allows for the expansion of solar energy, which by these independent firms like Eagle Point, because let's back up, companies like MidAmerican Energy, Alliant Energy, they also use solar power. They also use alternative energy sources. But these independent organizations will now be able to thrive and compete, which is actually kind of what concerned the Iowa Utilities Board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to speak to argue for the monopolies here, we give monopolies to public utility companies for a reason, like Alliant Energy and MidAmerican. They have huge fixed costs, power plants, lines that need to be paid for, right?
Exactly, and they're required to serve all the customers in their territory, even those customers who it's actually not beneficial to serve. It might cost more to serve them because they're way out in the middle of nowhere, yeah, Isolated by themselves. And so this is what could happen, and this is what the Iowa Utilities Board said, but the Iowa Supreme Court didn't buy, is that if big box stores, Home Depots, the local college in the city, if they all go on these solar panels, then those are very profitable customers that are coming away from the public utility, and therefore there are less people and less wealthy people who the public utility has to spread the cost of their power plant, and so it could raise energy costs for some of Iowa's most needy. That was the Public Utilities Board's concern, but the Iowa Supreme Court said we don't really see any evidence that that's going to happen.
I guess we'll have to wait in the years to come to see if that does happen, and siphoning it off of prime commercial or prime consumers of electric energy here. Any other implications you see before we move on?
Well, legally speaking, it's very good news for anyone. This case is very good news for anyone who wants to challenge agency action. The underlying legal issue that the court was fighting about here, and it was a split decision, was how much deference do you give to an agency? These are the experts. Do we defer to them on what legal terms, what these complicated legal terms meaning in this situation? And the majority of the Supreme Court said no, which means if now it's much easier for litigants to challenge a rule, to challenge a contested case proceeding, which is also good for lawyers.
Okay, if you want to look that up online, Eagle Point Solar v. Iowa Utilities Board, talking about decisions recently decided before the Iowa Supreme Court, with Ryan Copemans and Todd Pettis. Let's go to a couple of the other cases that this prompted legislative action?
Yeah, not as much as maybe the solar energy companies wanted to have done, but in kind of reaction to the story and the implication that maybe Iowa wasn't doing enough to encourage solar energy, the legislature increased the number of tax credits that was willing to give, from 50% of what the federal credits are up to 60% and so on. That, of course, still doesn't affect the problem of what happens when you're selling to a state utility. So at the end of the day, this decision very much helps, but it did prompt some legislative action to further encourage solar energy in the state of Iowa.
Another case before the Iowa Supreme Court in this last session, Nicoletto v. State, is also one that falls into this category of legislative action being prompted.
Yeah, so here you have a statute that says that a school employee cannot have a sexual relationship with the student. It seems kind of an obvious point to us, but in this case it was not a teacher, but instead was a coach who just had a coach's authorization, which is something you can get over the weekend. And he had another daytime job and had a sexual relationship with the student. The Iowa Supreme Court, again, a split decision, said this coach is not a school employee because he's not a, quote, licensed professional, how the legislature defines that term. And that isn't necessarily, well, it seems a little bit absurd because there are concerns with coaches, just as there are with teachers, of exploiting the relationship that goes on there. The language was definitely ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you would think as a parent that anybody my school allows me to come in contact with, an adult in more or less a teaching role, and we'll just say a coach, that would all be the same, but not, huh?
Yeah, and in fact, there might be more need for protection from coaches because coaches are often the ones that spend the most time with the students. And for some students, playing time is more important than grades. So there's that relationship that goes on there. But within 2 days, I think the governor called in the Iowa legislature to amend the statute. Then within a couple weeks at the end of the legislative session, when all these other crazy things are going on, the legislature did indeed amend the statute and make clear that coaches with only an authorization are subject to the sexual exploitation statute.
Okay. Another one in this category, Rhodes v. Iowa. We've talked about that in past shows, but remind us what that one's about.
Yeah, so this is about HIV transmission, the crime. So if you don't tell, you have HIV and you don't tell your partner, you can be convicted of a crime. Rhodes was convicted of that crime, put on the sex offender registry, and could have served serious jail time, prison time, but his sentence was reduced significantly. But his story made the national news, and kind of exposed, well, maybe, you know, these statutes which were passed in the 90s, maybe they need to be changed because we know more now about HIV. We know more about the transmission of it. And also the statute was based on HIV only. And some people were saying, look, it stigmatizes the disease in a way that's unnecessary. Mm-hmm. So what the legislature did is they actually repealed it and they created a general statute for many sexually transmitted diseases. And they separated the penalties. So if you actually intend to infect someone, that's much more serious than if you just didn't tell them but hoped, for example, that they didn't get infected. And also now if you use precautions, so probably if you use a condom or take other protective measures, you may have a defense to any criminal action that's brought against you, even if you didn't disclose your HIV status.
And Ryan, does this put us more in line with the laws, how they are changing in this regard in other states?
Actually, Iowa's becoming a little bit of the leader in this regard. So some other states have changed, but Iowa is somewhat taking the lead in changing their statute.
Okay. Ryan Copeman's with us, Todd Pettis, and we've got a couple of questions revolving around the cases that we've already heard. Before we move on, let me throw this out. With respect to the decision that law enforcement was allowed to pull someone over in an email from Amy, because the county was not visible. Amy asks, can law enforcement also pull over everyone with university vanity plates since they do not have a county listed on them? Interesting.
It's a good question. State law permits certain categories of license plates that don't mention the county name. I think there's a Pearl Harbor category, for example. A couple others, universities, if Amy's right, universities may well be on the list. The police can't pull you over for having one of those plates. Those plates are authorized by state law. And the court acknowledged that, yes, there are some counties that don't have, some license plates that don't have county names on them. But whatever they do have, whether it's a university reference or Pearl Harbor or some such thing, that too is sufficiently unique that it's worth leaving it exposed, because if a car with such a plate is on it and is fleeing a crime scene or an accident and someone wants to identify the car, whatever is there instead of the county name serves the same function of helping to identify the car. So police, if you have that on your plate, that's fine. If it's whatever is on your plate where the county name would otherwise be, if that is concealed, not fine, because those are letters that are on the plate and the frame is not allowed to cover up the letters on the plate.
Okay. But, Brian, you want to jump in here?
Well, yeah? I was going to say that's also a very good question, because coincidentally, the Iowa Supreme Court was actually wrestling with that issue at oral argument. That was addressed at length about these university plates, and some of the members of the court wondered out loud, well, if this is so important to see the county, then why do we allow these university plates? It ended up not to play that big of a role in the case, but it was certainly something that was on their mind.
Excellent email from Amy with that question. Chris, in a tweet, goes to the sidewalk case we talked about in the end of our first half hour. Chris asks, what if a sidewalk is damaged as a result of city assets, specifically snow plows? Who would be liable there? That's a nice twist on it.
It is. It is a nice twist, and I'm not going to offer an answer to it. I'd have to go back and see if the ordinance anticipates, you know, what the who damaged it. But my common sense instinct, like most listeners, I'm sure, is that if the city bashes it up with a snowplow, I would think the city's on the hook. But you know, I don't know. I'd want to take a look at the ordinance.
It's seems like question. It seems like that would make sense. Great tweet from Chris, tweeting us at IPR Talk. Ryan, let's talk before the hour ends about Iowa Farm Bureau v. Environmental Protection Commission, a case recently before the Iowa Supreme Court decided there. Tell us that story.
Yeah, another big win for environmental groups. So in the 1980s, the EPA passed a law that required states to adopt policies that would prevent the degradation of water quality. So as I said, the 80s. It took Iowa a long time to get around to that. It happened in 2007. The DNR finally started the process of talking about these water quality rules. At that time, there was a member of the Environmental Protection Commission who was also on an environmental advocacy group. She was a hired staffer, and her job was to propose and work on water quality regulations like this. So the regulation ended up going through, went up to the Environmental Protection Council, and this woman ended up voting on the rule that she had, in a sense, colloquially lobbied for while it was at the DNR stage. In addition to that, there was another member of the commission who had actually since being appointed by Governor Culver, had moved to Montana, had registered to vote in Montana, and so she was no longer an elector of Iowa, as we talked about in the first half hour about what it means to be an elector. So she really wasn't eligible to be on the commission. So the Iowa Farm Bureau, not really liking this anti-degradation rule so much, filed a district court action challenging it, saying that these two commission members should have recused themselves or should have been off. And the district court declined that, and the Iowa Supreme Court also just last week said no, it was okay that they were on the commission, or at least that the in the case of the woman who moved to Montana, that her ineligible status did not void the rule.
Mm. Okay, very interesting. Also, as we clean out some loose ends here, some other interesting cases. Palmer College of Chiropractic v. Cannon. This has to do, Todd, with a blind person wanting to be a chiropractor.
Right. Aaron Cannon, who is blind, applied to Palmer College of Chiropractic in Davenport. They have locations outside Iowa, too, but one of their schools is in Davenport. Applied for a graduate program, wanted to become a chiropractor, and Palmer College told him that he would be able to go, you know, a certain ways through the program, but that he was then going to run into a problem. And the problem that they said he would run into was that a course in radiology, how to read x-rays, was part of the curriculum. They said, how are you going to read x-rays? And he said, well, we should explore ways to accommodate my disability. For example, we could have someone else, just a lay person, look at the x-ray and tell me what describe it for me, and I could ask that person questions about it. That would be an accommodation. And Palmer College said, no, we don't think that that's reasonable. We think you need to be able to do it yourself. You shouldn't be dependent in that way on someone, what someone else is telling you about shades of gray or what have you in the x-ray. To make a long story short, the Supreme Court held that this was a violation of his rights. There's a kind of a trio of sources of law. There's a Davenport civil rights law. There's state-level law. There's federal-level law, all pointing toward the same end. And to categorize those quickly, you have to make reasonable accommodations of those with disabilities. And here, the court said, you know, the Palmer College has to show that allowing him to go through this program would amount to a fundamental alteration of the curriculum. And Palmer College has not shown that. Just real quickly to give you a flavor of the debate, Justice Waterman wrote a dissent joined by Mansfield, and he says in his opening paragraph or two, what's next? We're going to have air traffic controllers who are blind, relying on people to tell them what's on the screen. And
interesting. Fascinating case there. Let's squeeze in Chris from Des Moines right before we end the hour. Chris, you'll have to make it quick, but I know you have a question about our sidewalk issue.
Yeah, is there a limit on damages for that?
If someone should injure themselves on your sidewalk, do we know that? So how much can you be on the hook for?
I don't know of any limit. Ryan, do you?
No, I don't.
No, so I would assume that there is no limit.
What if I, you know, to reduce my liability, and I had a bad sidewalk, and I just said, well, I'm just going to take it all out and make grass. Can you do that? Or would the city say, no, you have to have a sidewalk?
Like you have to have a
sidewalk. Yeah, that'd be a different question of state law, a different ordinance about whether you can replace the sidewalk with grass.
Because, you know, it's your property, but yeah, there's kind of dual partnership there.
Yeah,
your property taxes, you know.
A fascinating area of law. Chris, you raised a great question. Thank you for calling from Des Moines. Our hour has ended with Ryan Copeman's a litigator with Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. You bring such fascinating cases to talk about. I think we need to have you, Todd, and Ryan back here. You've sparked a lot of interest in our audience, I know, about our sidewalks, about our license plates. And thank you for the analysis and the storytelling.
Well, we'd love to do it. We really enjoy this.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury, along with Claire Roth. Tomorrow, our News Buzz edition of the program. You'll want to join us again over the noon hour. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Get in touch with us anytime. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.